Twangin' Eddie. I think we have a CD malfunction, but what a coincidence, because it malfunctioned right on the part. Twangin' Eddie. Dwayne, are you there?
I am here, Ronnie. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Ladies and gentlemen, Dwayne Eddie is simply the most successful rock and roll instrumentalist of all time. Dwayne, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you tonight, and look forward to talking about some of the old songs and telling some stories about the old days.
What does the term twang mean? Is that something that you invented?
Well, I invented the sound and the style of playing and getting that sound, but the name twang came about in the studio one day. Somebody said, man, that guitar sounds twangy. And my producer, Lee Hazelwood, his partner, Lester Sill, had never heard that expression, and cracked him up. So it became a running joke in the studio. Every time I hit a particularly twangy note, well, they'd start kidding about it being twangy, and it went from there. And then when we put the first album out later that year, we titled it Dwayne Eddie, His Twangy Guitar and the Rebels. And it stuck with me ever since, and actually became kind of a genre of its own.
How would you describe exactly what it is in terms of a few words? Is it playing the guitar a certain way?
Yeah, playing on the bass strings, playing a melody or a riff on the bass strings, and getting a big sound on it and a clear sound, and just rocking and rolling.
Or moving and grooving. Speaking of which, this was your very first hit single, and how high did it get on the chart?
It got to about 71 or 72 with an anchor.
With an anchor.
As opposed to a bullet.
As opposed to a bullet, but it was a start. Anyway, let's listen to it. Ladies and gentlemen, the debut hit by Dwayne Eddie. This is Moving and Grooving. Moving and grooving, Dwayne Eddy, Mr. Twangy Guitar himself. And I want to mention, and we will mention it more in detail a little bit later on, Dwayne, you were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in the year 1994. So I guess you'd have to say that was a very good year.
Yeah, that was fun. I enjoyed that experience. I
want to mention that the lead-off recording that you heard a part of at the beginning of the show was by Joanne Campbell, and she was doing a song called Dwayne, and just happened to be about a guy who played guitar. Big coincidence there.
Well, we worked together in a lot of rock and roll on the early Alan Freed shows back in 1958-59 at the Brooklyn Fox in New York, and became friends. And I guess she wrote a song about me.
Right after that, we heard a little bit of Life is a Rock, But the Radio Rolled Me by a group called Reunion, and the lead singer of that was Joey Levine. You were born in Corning, New York, and you started playing guitar at the age of five. Who were your guitar heroes?
My guitar heroes, well, I love going. I used to go to the movies on Saturday afternoon when I was a kid and see Gene Autry, Roy Rogers, and different cowboy stars, Rex Allen and so forth. And as I grew up, I listened to the radio, mostly country radio, and I loved Hank Williams, Sr. I grew up listening to his things, and Lefty Frizzell, and Carl Smith, and people like that. But having an influence on me, Hank Williams was one of the biggest, because he taught me to be sincere. I mean, not personally, but his records were so sincere, and to do it with authority, and get your own style. So that's what I did when I started recording. And people that influenced me along the way were people like, of course, Les Paul and Chet Atkins as guitar players. And Louis Armstrong was a big influence because he also, when he picked up that trumpet and started to play, he made every note count. And that's what I've tried to do. It doesn't matter what instrument you're playing, as long as you make all the notes count and do it with authority.
Dwayne, were you self-taught or did you actually take guitar lessons?
No, my dad taught me about three or four chords when I was 5, 6 years old, and I just took it from there and play along with songs on the radio. And luckily, we always had a radio, and I'd listen to the country stations when I could and play along with the songs on there. That's the way I learned to play.
Yeah, of course, you learned quite a bit of the single note picking, not just the guitar chords, so you had to pick that up yourself.
Right. Well, that comes with it. You know, you take a solo, it's a lot of it single note picking. That's how I learned.
Your first big hit was Rebel Rouser. That was a top 10 record, but that has a kind of interesting story behind it because that was not supposed to be the side that was going to be the hit.
No, what happened was after Moving and Grooving did what we considered fairly well and at least got into the charts and everything, the record company said, go back and do some more. So we went back in and did several more tracks, and among them was a song I wrote one morning at the session called Rebel Rouser. When we got ready to put the record out, they put Stalkin' on as a B-side. Well, I thought it was going to be the B-side, but the producers, Lee Hazelwood, Lester Sill, the record company, and Dick Clark at American Bandstand all thought that Stalkin' was going to be the side. They all liked that better than Rebel Rouser, so they started plugging that, and Dick Clark played it for a couple of weeks straight every day. They felt it was a great follow-up to Moving and Grooving, and I didn't think so. I didn't think it was the side, you know?
We're just going to hear just a few seconds of it. It's a very bluesy type of a song, and it's not an easy one to dance to. But let's just take a listen to what Stalkin' sounded like. You know what they could do to that? They could probably do a very slow stroll to it.
Yeah, the stroll didn't come along till later that very year, though.
That was the problem.
Diamonds came along with the stroll.
So they hadn't.
Well, they could have done a stroll to it.
They hadn't invented the dance, but you had the record. So how did it turn out that Rebel Rouser became the A side?
It wasn't until many months, maybe a year later. In fact, that was about 2 or 3 years later. Dick Clark said to me one day when we were on a bus tour. He said, did I ever tell you how I happened to turn over Stockin? I said, no, you never did. And I never did know what happened, really. And I just figured the record company had asked you to turn it over and play the other side. He said, well, no. He says, what happened was, he says, I was doing record hops in those days. One Friday night I went out, and he said I'd have a box of records for each hour. So I'd take three boxes of singles, and I'd play the A-sides and the hits and for 3 hours at the record hop. And he said, one night I came to the third hour, and I looked around, and I couldn't find my third box, and apparently I had left it at home. And so he said the only thing I could do was go back through the boxes of singles that I had, and so I told everybody, I'm going to play the B-sides of some of these records and see what you think of those.
Yep.
And he came to Stockin, and he turned it over and played the B-side of that, and it was
Rebel Rouser.
Rebel Rouser. And he said the kids came up and asked him to play it about three more times that night. He figured out from that he'd been playing the wrong side and turned it over, and he scheduled it for the following Monday.
And the group on it was called the Sharps, and they eventually recorded a hit on their own under a different name, right? The Rivingtons?
Yeah. When we cut Rebel Rouser, Lee took it over to L.A. We cut all these things in Phoenix, Arizona, at the studio, local studio there, and all the basic tracks and everything, but we didn't have a rock and roll sax player, so we had to go to L.A. for that and overdub the sax. So he took it to L.A. at Gold Star Studios, and he'd overdub the sax there. He also had the Sharps come along because he wanted some oohs and ahs on the record and hand claps.
The Rebel Yells and whatever.
Well, that was the Sharps. You know, they started doing it. They were clapping and oohing and ahing and everything, and they got caught up in the moment and started, and one of them yelled, and Lee said, leave that in. Keep doing that. So they did, and that's how the record turned out.
That was a great sound call, Rebel Rouser, and I have Twangin' Eddie on the phone, and I'm going to stop saying Twangin' Eddie because I'll be overdoing it. Dwayne Eddie, the rock and roll legend, is on the phone. That sounds, I think, a little bit better. Dwayne, thank you again for joining us tonight for this.
It's all my pleasure, Ronnie. Thank you for having me.
The follow-up record to Rebel Rouser was something called Ramrod. Had the same kind of alliteration, Rebel Rouser and Ramrod, even though it was just one word there. What's the story behind Ramrod?
Well, Ramrod was a song that we had a track cut, but didn't have the sax on it yet, or the yells or anything, and I'd gone back to do some promotion in Philadelphia and New York and all up down the coast, and I did American Bandstand in the afternoons to promote Rebel Rouser, and one day Dick said, I'm going to Miami for the Saturday night show. They had a Saturday night beach nut show every Saturday, and usually it came out of the little theater in New York on West 44th Street.
Everybody was wearing their flavorific buttons?
Yes, and all the artists. And instead of playing records for dancing, all the artists would show up and do their record on a half-hour show. So we decided to do it on location in Miami, the Miami Beach, wherever it was. So we went down there, did the show, and while we were rehearsing and doing the run-throughs and everything, Dick came up to me and said, would you like to do the opening for the show? He says, we'd like to have a live opening. He says, you could do Moving and Groovin' if you could play it live. And I said, yes, of course I can. So we did that. During the show, I did Rebel Rouser, where they put me on a forklift and drove me down through the audience to the stage, and we all jumped off, the guys and myself, the Rebels, and finished up the song on stage.
Yeah, well, you were guitar syncing.
Yeah, we were, yeah.
Not lip syncing, but guitar syncing.
Pick syncing.
Pick syncing, good,
yeah.
Very good.
We finished that up, and then Dick says, well, we'd like to have a closer. Have you got anything really up-tempo? That he says, Stockin's too slow, and that's all he knew of my stuff then. He says, the B-side of Moving and Grooving, which is called Up and Down, isn't really up-tempo enough. And I said, well, I've got this song we've got a track on called Ramrod. We could do that. And he said, well, let me hear it. So we played it for him. He said, that's perfect. So we did it, and it closed the show. And we did it live. And Monday morning, there were 150,000 orders on the record company's desk. You know, they wanted that song.
But the record wasn't out.
And the record wasn't finished. So they called me in a panic on Monday evening and said, we've got to have that record finished. And I said, well, you'll have to talk to Lee about that. So they called him, and he called me. He said, well, I know what you did. So he says, I know how the arrangement went and what you had in mind. He says, I think I can get it done. So
you got it done.
Took it in Tuesday and overdubbed the Price Johnson on the sax and had the Rivingtons come in, or the Sharps, I should say, and do their yells and oohs and ahs and sent it to the pressing plant. Wednesday they started pressing it and shipping it, and by Friday it was in the stores. Less than a week after I'd done it live on Dick's Saturday night show.
And it also became a top 40 record, too.
It did.
This is Duane Eddy and Ramrod. Only a minute and 42 seconds, but you certainly got a lot in that minute and 42 seconds, Duane. Wow.
It's a fun little record. We just rocked and rolled with that.
You also rocked and rolled with a song called Cannonball.
Well, we had originally titled it White Lightning. You know, that wasn't supposed to be coming out just when it did. We were going to release a song called The Lonely One. I guess maybe the fact that Stockin' was slow scared everybody, because when they heard The Lonely One, everybody said, oh, it's too slow, it'll never make it. I was slated to do the Dick Clark Saturday Night Show again and introduce The Lonely One is my new single. And Dick and my manager got together and decided it just wouldn't work. It was too slow. So they said, do you have anything else? And I said, well, not really. I don't think there's anything more in the can. And we called Lee. Said, well, have you got any ideas? And I said, well, I've been kicking around a couple things on the road, because I was on the road all the time at that point. And he said, well, if you can come back to Phoenix, we'll cut something, and hopefully that'll be it. And so Steve Douglas, my sax player, and I got on a plane. They were prop planes back then, and flew from New York back to Phoenix, flew all night long, and had breakfast and cleaned up and went to the studio, and we cut Cannonball that day live with all the guys. And we also cut it in stereo, because we had four-track machine by then in the studio. We could do stereo.
Oh, was this your first hit record that was recorded in stereo?
Yes, it was. First record I ever cut in stereo. One of the first in rock and roll, I think, for rock and rollers to cut stereo.
Wow.
But, of course, we mixed the mono mix for radio.
You could have it both ways.
Yeah.
Back then.
Oh, yeah, I had to. Yeah, you had to in those days.
Hmm.
And Lee mixed it, and we cut an acetate, and Steve and I got back on an airplane and flew back to New York. By this time, it's Friday night, and we flew back, got in New York at 6 o'clock in the morning, went to our hotel, cleaned up, went down to the little theater on 44th Street about 10 o'clock that morning, and presented my acetate to Dick and my manager, and they disappeared into some office in the back of the building and listened to it, came out all smiles, and said, that's great. But they said, we don't know about the title, White Lightning. We don't think it's a good title. It kind of suggests drinking to the kids.
Now, there was a song, White Lightning, by George.
There was, but we didn't know it at this point, at this time. We hadn't heard it, but it was
right.
It was already out, I think,
yeah,
by George Jones, one of my favorite country singers of all time.
And by the way, a footnote to that, written by the big bopper, J.P. Richardson.
Yeah,
by the way.
Right.
You changed the title to Cannonball.
Then we changed it over, so I called Lee and I said, oh, they don't like the title White Lightning. It's too suggestive of who's and everything. That's not right for the kids. We were concerned about the kids' psyche in those days, you know, audience, teenagers. And so we kicked it around a while and came up with Cannonball.
Okay, right now we're going to have a few shots of Cannonball.
There you go.
Here's Duane Eddy. That was a song originally called White Lightning, but it ended up as Cannonball, and that was a big hit record for you, Duane.
It was a good one.
We're going to move to a record that could be part of an Abbott and Costello routine. I can say, can you tell me the title of another one of your records? And you're supposed to say, yep.
Yep.
So can you tell me the title of the next record we're going to play, Duane?
Yep.
Can you tell me where it was recorded?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I know, yep, okay. Where was it recorded, Duane?
It was recorded in New York City. I was on the road, and we didn't have time to go back to Phoenix, so I had my group with me at the time, a road group, and we just went in the studio. We recorded it in New York.
Yep. and that was called Yep. Is that right, Dwayne? Was that called Yep?
Yep.
Want to mention Lee Hazlewood originally was a disc jockey, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. And that's why the sound doesn't change from doing it in New York or Phoenix or Los Angeles, Hollywood, because he was very good at getting a good sound on these records. I credit him with doing the mixes and working hard enough on the sound where it still holds up pretty good after all this time.
He co-wrote a lot of these songs with you, right?
Yes, we wrote most of them together. We just worked it out. Whether he came up with the germ of the idea or I did, it didn't matter. We just split it 50-50.
Sadly, Lee Hazlewood passed away.
It was August 4th.
Then, of course, he wrote the immortal Nancy Sinatra recorded song called
His Boots Are Made for Walking.
We're going to move to a song called 40 Miles of Bad Road. And I guess when people hear this song, they imagine 40 Miles of Bad Road. But it was actually inspired by a comment about a woman.
That's right. We were kicking around the idea. We knew it sounded like a rough road or a dirt road or something. We were looking at all those roads out there in Arizona across the desert, and we thought, that'd make a good title for this song. And we were trying to think of it. As it happened, one day we took off for the afternoon and went to a movie downtown just to kind of clear our heads from all the recording. And we were standing in the line waiting to get in to see the movie, and there was two old Texans standing behind us, and they were talking about the girls they dated, and they were kidding each other about how cute or ugly each other's girlfriend was. And one of them said, well, I had the best looking girl last night. And the other one said, you did not. And he said, I did too. And the other one said, I had the best looking girl last night. And the first one said, no, he says, your girl had a face on her like 40 miles of bad road. He fell down nearly from laughing so hard.
I'm falling down.
And we had our title.
Now that you've told me this story, I will never, when I hear this record, think of it the same way that I used to think about it.
I know. I probably shouldn't have told anybody that because it kind of destroys everybody's illusion. But it's still, that's what we were looking for. And it is about 40 miles of bad road. It's just that we couldn't put it together till we heard that saying.
That was quite a record and quite a title as well, and quite a story. This is Ronnie Allen, and I'm so honored to be talking to the most successful rock and roll instrumentalist of all time. I know I said that at the beginning of the show, but you're important enough that I could say it a second time. Peter Gunn was one of the top TV shows back in the late 50s. It starred Craig Stevens. Henry Mancini wrote the song, the theme from Peter Gunn. Henry never had a hit single with it. Ray Anthony had a hit single. And then, Dwayne, you had a hit single with Peter Gunn.
I did, and mine was quite by accident. I'd cut it for an album, And I wasn't even going to do that. But Steve Douglas, the sax player, came in one morning. We were doing the second album, especially for you. Guess what? He says, I learned Peter Gunn last night. And I said, well, great. And he says, why don't we record it? And I said, well, there's not a heck of a lot for me to do except play that riff over and over again, you know, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, just over and over. And he said, well, I sure wish we could, but I kind of put him off, and then we've kind of finished up the album, got close to the end, and we had one more song to do, and Lee and I were standing there discussing it, and Steve wandered up and said, how about Peter Gunn? he kept after us, so Lee said, well, that is a good idea, not a bad idea. And I said, yeah, I guess I could do some things at the front, you know, with the guitar and make an intro and then kick into the riff, and Steve could come in, and then we could do it in the middle again. And so that's what we did, and finished it up and put it on the album. And a few weeks later, or a few months later, actually, I guess it was, they used to send out the records in those days to different companies around the world. And the company in America was just in America. And in London, they had London Records. And I don't know who they had in Australia, but whoever the company was down there didn't like the new single, which might have been Yep or something like that.
They said nope.
They said nope. And so they took Peter Gunn out of the album, made it a single, and it was a top 10 record down there. London Records saw this happen, and they thought, well, gee, that'd be good for, that might be good here, too. So they put it out as a single, and it got to be number one in England. And finally, after all that happened, and it was a hit around the world, then finally the record company here in America decided, gee, maybe we should put it out as a single here, and they did, and it was another hit here.
That's Dwayne Eddy's version of Peter Gunn. Dwayne is on the phone. I'm Ronnie Allen. And Dwayne, you have a record. I don't know if, I guess this would be in the Guinness Book of World Records. It's certainly in the Billboard or the Joel Whitburn Book of Records, I guess. Some Kind of Earthquake. In fact, our discussion of Some Kind of Earthquake may be longer than the record itself, which only ran a minute and 17 seconds, making it the shortest top 40 hit ever.
Well, we said all we had to say in the minute and 17 seconds. As simple as that. After we got it done, we realized there was a little bonus factor there in the sense that Lee, having been a DJ in his previous life, before he became a record producer, realized that DJs would like this record because at the end of their shows, when they come to the top of the hour and go into the 5-minute news break, they'd have to start a record and fade it out halfway through. And he said they ought to like this because they can play it all the way through because it's only a minute and 17 seconds.
It's over. Some kind of earthquake. Dwayne Eddy, real short record. But, Dwayne, that's not the shortest record of all time to make the chart. The shortest record of all time to make the Hot 100 was by the Women Folk, and it was called Little Boxes.
Yes, I know.
Remember that?
Yeah.
And you remember what they were made of? They were made of ticky-tacky.
Yep. Cute little record.
As I was listening to that one, it occurred to me that the outro to Hey Jude is probably about four times as long as Some Kind of Earthquake.
Yep.
Dwayne Eddy is on the phone with me, a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and maybe this is a good time to mention that. 1994, you were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. What did that mean to you personally? Was this something that you thought was going to happen, and how did you feel about it?
Well, yeah, I figured it would happen. It took a while. They nominated me 18 times before they finally voted me in, but it was great fun. We went up to New York and to the Waldorf Astoria and the ballroom there and have a big dinner. Everybody gets up. They have a film presentation, and then you have to make a little speech, thank you and all that. It was fun. I sat at a table with Eric Clapton and Jeff Beck and Mick Jones of Foreigner, and Chuck Berry was sitting right behind me, and Dion of Dion and the Belmonts, Dion DiMucci. And it was fun seeing old friends and making new ones, and Mick Jones inducted me.
In the year that you were inducted, 1994, your fellow artists who were inducted were Elton John, Rod Stewart, John Lennon as a soloist, Bob Marley, and the Grateful Dead. And that's not small potatoes.
No, that was a good bunch of folks. And Paul McCartney was there to do a little speech about John Lennon, which was very sad and sweet. It was a good speech. He and Linda both were there that night and came over and talked to us for a while, and it was just a great, fun night.
Your biggest record on the chart was not Rebel Rouser, but it was Because They're Young, and this one had a very different sound from everything that preceded it.
Well, it was the second record, I guess, that had strings on it. Second rock and roll record to have big string orchestra on it. The first one being Buddy Holly's It Doesn't Matter Anymore.
Written by Paul Anka. That's
yeah.
A great song. That was a posthumous hit by Buddy Holly.
Yeah, right. It came out after he got killed.
Your strings on this particular record, this was, in fact, the title song of a movie.
Right. Dick Clark and decided to act and be in a movie, and he did, and it was called Because They're Young. And I think James Dearn and Tuesday Weld were in the movie. I also appeared in the movie to do my latest single, which was Shazam. And they wanted us to do the theme song, both for the movie, and then I didn't think it was going to be a single because there was no way I could do it on the road. You know, I couldn't carry a string orchestra with me in those days and recreate it live. They surprised me. They put it out as an EP, and they said it was doing so well as an EP, they had to take it out of the EP and make it a single, so they did. And it was fun recording it because it was the first time I'd recorded with strings and the first time the L.A. Philharmonic had recorded with a rock and roll artist. So they all came in their suits and ties and lined up and filed in and sat down and were all proper and quiet, and read the music the arranger gave them, and we started and recorded the song. We did two songs that day, and when it was over, they all packed up their violins and cellos and things and filed out.
Maybe it was because it sounded so different, and the combination of the guitar and the strings worked so well that this became your biggest hit ever, and we're going to listen to it right now. This is Duane Eddy, Because They're Young. Was Because They're Young by Duane Eddy, and the time is just flying. This is just so much fun. I hope this is fun for you, Duane, because I'm
Old men love to tell their stories, don't they?
Who said you're old? It's only if you feel old.
You're too kind.
We're going to move on to Pepe, and that was the title song of a motion picture starring a comedian named Canton Flass.
Yeah, raft of stars in that picture. Everybody from Kim Novak to Edward G. Robinson, and I don't remember everybody, but there was a bunch of them I know. I went to a party in New York, the big opening party for the movie. Met some of them. Very fun, interesting. And I'd had the hit record already. The movie company asked the record company if they'd get me to record Pepe so they could possibly have a hit on it before the movie came out, just to get everybody thinking that way, you know. The song would be familiar to everybody before they ever heard it in the movie. And I did that, and it, sure enough, it did become a hit. And
it helped the movie.
I don't know if it helped the movie. It probably, with all the publicity it had at the time, I don't think it needed it, but it was nice I got to go to the party anyway.
the recordings we've played thus far were for the Jamie record label. Because Jamie was based in Philadelphia, many people probably thought you were from Philadelphia, but that was not the case.
I don't think anybody thought that.
I did.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry.
I'm sure there were a few people who thought that. I don't think the bulk of them did because pictures on the album covers.
For many years, I thought, because I assumed that if a record company was based in a certain town, then probably the recording artist was. I actually did think that you were from Philadelphia because of the record label.
I never heard of any big recording studios in Philadelphia. I'm sure they had one or two, but most of the Philly artists, Frankie Avalon and Bobby Rydell and all that, I believe they did their records in New York.
Right. But later on, I think, with Gamble and Huff, the Stylistics, later on, I think they had a lot of records recorded in Philadelphia.
Yeah, probably did.
We have time for a couple more records, and everything we've played thus far was on the Jamie record label. You switched to RCA Victor. Was it RCA Victor at the time, or just RCA?
Yes, RCA Victor.
RCA Victor. Did they still have Little Nipper, the dog, on those records?
Oh, yeah. I believe they did, yeah.
Ruff, ruff. And you recorded The Ballad of Paladin?
Well, I recorded it because I had done a small part in a movie called Thunder of Drums with Richard Boone and met him and became good friends with him, and such good friends that ended up doing a couple of acting jobs in Have Gun, Will Travel, his series as Paladin.
Did you play the good guy or the bad guy?
Well, it was a bad guy who turned out to be a good guy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was a mountain boy in a feud. And it was a cute little story called The Education of Sarah Jane, the episode. And then I did a Christmas Paladin, too, where I was kind of the guy that came in, was kind of Joseph. My wife was pregnant, about to have a baby, and I didn't have any place to stay in this western town. And so we went in the saloon looking for a place, and she had the baby in the back room of the saloon, and Paladin helped out. And it was another cute little story. It was nice. So I got to be friends with him and decided to record the song.
And lo and behold, another hit.
Yeah, written by Johnny Western. Johnny's a great guy. He's a DJ in Wichita.
Ballad of Paladin, Dwayne Eddy. And Dwayne, the time has just flown.
It has. We've crowded quite a bit of music in this last hour, though, haven't we?
We sure did. And Dwayne, once again, I can't thank you enough for doing this. And I know you have so many fans throughout the world who appreciate your music. I want to give a big mention to a CD that's been out for 14 years, and it is still available in places like Amazon and Barnes & Noble, a lot of different places. It's called Twang Thang, and if any of you want to know exactly what twang means, this is Dwayne Eddy, 101, 102, 103, 104, and 105. You get your college
that's
degree.
It's a good cross-section of stuff I've done through the years. And
40 tracks. Good.
And the sound on it is really good.
You remastered these?
We remastered it here in Nashville with Denny Purcell.
Right.
Georgetown, and it just turned out he did a beautiful job. Sometimes they don't. They change the mix when they remaster things, and you hear things you never heard before, but we kept it true to its roots, and so it's the most definitive package I have out there.
By the way, Twang Fang has a fantastic booklet written by a gentleman named Dan Fort. He's a guitar player, and he's a Duane Eddy expert.
He is. He's an expert on all kinds of music, all things guitar. He's a great writer, and he writes a lot of stories for Guitar Player magazine, mm-hmm. and all different kinds of magazines, and has been doing it for years. He also has a fantastic collection. I don't know if you've heard of Tysco Del Rey, but that's
sure.
Dan, and he's got the most complete collection you've ever seen of weird, strange guitars.
Yeah.
He is a great writer, and he did a great job. He came down to the house and stayed a few days just so he'd get his facts all straight.
It's got a lot of great pictures as well.
Yeah, we supply those as pictures I collected over the years that my wife, Dee, sorted out and organized, and so she was able to give them those pictures to put in the booklet.
And I want to point out that the recordings that you're hearing on this show are all from this double CD called Twang Fang, the Duane Eddy Anthology, and it's put out by Rhino Records.
Yep.
All right, Duane, the last recording we're going to play is a little bit different from the previous ones because the previous ones were really instrumentals, except if you want to say, well, they were part vocal when you had the sharps doing the rebel yells and things like that, but basically there were no lyrics to those other songs. This is going to be our send-off record. Anything you want to mention about Dance with the Guitar Man?
Well, this was, as you say, the first thing where we had any lyrics, and he'd come up with this one verse of it, and I worked out the music for it, and we sat down and wrote it one day, and he finished up a couple other verses, and then we hired the Blossoms to do the singing on it, and the verse sort of sets up the instrumental and comes back in and tells a little more of the story.
Darlene Love was the lead singer of the Blossoms.
Right, yes.
Duane, want to thank you once again, and maybe sometime down the road, down the 40 miles of good road, we'll do it again.
I hope so. It's been fun, and I enjoyed it, and look forward to hearing the finished show when you get it done.
I want to wish you continued success in all your endeavors. Let's take it out right now. Everybody, get up off your seats and
dance with the Guitar Man.
Thank you. Well, that's our show. And I thank you so much for listening. And I hope you'll stick around for just about 5 more minutes, because I got a couple of bonus tracks for you. The first one is by Joanne Campbell. This is the complete recording of her tribute to the star of our show. Finally, here's a recording that Dwayne mentioned during the show, but we didn't play. Gonna play it now. This is called Shazam.